This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today was born in Yorkshire, United Kingdom, graduated from Lancaster University in 1986 with degrees in computer science and physics. He has worked in software engineering and development in the fields of process control, telecommunications, and computer graphics. He realized that the official story of 9/11 was false in August of 2004 and has been engaged in various campaigning and research activities ever since, having joined Scholars for 9/11 Truth in January of 2005. He has most recently been involved in consolidating and reviewing eyewitness reports from New York City in relation to reports of aircraft. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the Dynamic Duo Andrew Johnson. Andrew, welcome aboard.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for inviting me on. It's a great pleasure to be speaking with you tonight.
We had an announcement on the news part. I don't know if you were able to hear it, about a prosecution that's taking place now, which has been described in Prison Planet by Paul Joseph Watson as seven retards returned for War on Terror show trial. It appears that these were some pot-smoking wannabe gang members who were approached by FBI agents who posed as Al-Qaeda terrorists and offered them $50,000 if they started waging a holy war in America. It's really quite bizarre, and it's hard to take seriously the idea that this ragtag group could possibly have posed a threat to the United States. They look like a mini-gang. And it's just stunning the extent to which the United States is going to try to fabricate a terrorist threat here to this country. But, of course, the biggie of all time is 9/11. Andrew, and here one of the most controversial issues of all is whether planes actually hit the towers. I know, as long as I have been involved in 9/11 research, that one of the most important arguments being advanced is that there were thousands of individuals who were watching the towers at the time in New York, and it would have been inconceivable that no planes had hit the towers. And yet I gather, based upon your research, in fact, a lot of questions can be raised about that kind of purported support for that position.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you know, we've heard quite a few people saying that if you try and trace through the witness testimony, there aren't that many people who can give, you know, a firm account of actually seeing the planes hit the towers. And I mean, you know, I must go back to my own experiences, perhaps paralleling your own, that, you know, I was quite incredulous about this idea, even when I'd sort of studied the, you know, destruction of the towers and initially thought, well, they must have been blown up somehow. I still found it very difficult to accept that the idea of the planes, you know, not going into the towers, well, that could be bogus as well. It took me quite a while to get used to that idea, and I had to study the evidence. But yes, to start the story of this, as perhaps your listeners know, Dr. Reynolds has, through Jerry Leapart, has put together this key TAM case against NIST, and much of the thrust of that is based on the sort of the NIST analysis of the plane crashes. That's one of the sort of main prongs of the case. And so Jerry Leapart, he kind of said, well, look, we've got all this data on the New York Times website from the first responder accounts of the emergency service personnel. These are the firemen, mainly the firemen, actually, and then the we've got the EMS workers. And there is actually an archive of over 500 accounts on the New York Times website. And, you know, you can actually download all of these accounts and read them, which is basically what we did. And Jerry had asked us to look through the accounts and look at where the planes were being talked about and what was said about them. And this work was initially split up between a group of about six of us, maybe seven. And, you know, I started to look into the accounts that Jerry had asked me to look at, and I found quite quickly that there was a lot more going on in these accounts than first sort of met the eye and you'd first think. And this whole idea of them seeing the planes crashing and how they described it threw up a lot of inconsistencies.
Let's just review your methodology then, Andrew. You had these oral histories given by over 500 emergency service first responders to the 9/11 tragedy that were posted on the New York Times website. And that what you decided to do was to not just download the accounts, but use text searching software to scan and determine primarily where each person was when the second plane is supposed to have hit the tower, where they were when the first crash occurred, if you could determine that, enter it into a database, and then seek to count or determine how many actually heard the second plane or saw the second plane or both heard and saw the second plane.
That's it. That's basically what I did. I mean, there's quite a bit of sort of grunt work involved in that, in terms of, you know, if you imagine you had to click 500 links to download 500 files, and obviously that's a bit of a laborious task. So the first thing to do is actually get some software to do that for you, which I already had. And then we had to, the PDF format isn't kind of very easily searchable. And initially I sort of came up with some erroneous results because the Adobe Reader, which I think most people have seen or used at some point on their computer, that does have a search facility where you can search for keywords. In other words, you sort of press the Control F or something, and then the search box will come up, and you just put in there plane or jet, and it will actually search through not just one file, but you can click a box, and it will search through a whole batch of files for that keyword, and then you can click on the line, and you can read the text, you know, around that portion of the account to save you reading the whole thing. So I kind of had to go on from that a bit so I could do this within a reasonable length of time, because I think the total amount of data that you're dealing with is something like about 12,000 pages if you printed it out. So to actually, you know, go through that without some kind of keyword searching would be very, very laborious.
The most important keywords you were using then were plane, jet, airplane, aircraft, but I take it you also added words such as missile, rocket, plane parts, luggage, suitcases, landing gear, and once you got into it, the fact that some were reporting having heard or seen fighter aircraft like F-15s or F-16s, you also searched for that.
That's right. I mean, once I sort of got into it, and I think you know, I obviously remember about the F-15 jets coming over, but when Jerry sort of initially laid out the task before us, he hadn't sort of included that. But then I think I read one of the accounts through to the end, and the person concerned sort of said, oh, you know, we were in the midst of everything and all this debris everywhere, and then we heard the F-15 jets coming over, and we thought it was another attack. And I thought, well, if they heard the F-15 jets, why didn't they hear the Boeings? And I've got a few accounts that I sort of picked out, you know, to do with that. And so that seemed like a fairly obvious sort of thing to check for. And I managed to pull out about, I think, six or seven accounts of hearing these jets, the F-15s, that is. And there are probably more, because I didn't search, for example, for the word fighter. That's one thing I didn't do. And there is such a large quantity of data here that, you know, there's a lot more searching can be done on it.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Andrew Johnson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest, Andrew Johnson, is from the UK. He has degrees in physics and computer science. He's a 9/11 activist and researcher, and he's been studying witness reports from New York City in relation to aircraft. I'm stunned by a news report just came out, Andrew, where ABC is reporting that 3,200 people are trapped underground after an accident at a South African gold mine, where that's approximately the number that died on 9/11. In some ways, I think that ought to help us to put into perspective, you know, the numbers question. I mean, we think it's a great trauma of recent American history, as indeed it was, especially psychologically. But these, you know, disasters on a comparable scale go on not infrequently around the world, alas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier about the bomb plot or the plot to, you know, commit acts of terrorism. We've got exactly the same sort of thing going on here in the UK. We had a case in the news earlier in the week where somebody had sent out letter bombs or apparently it was exaggerated a little bit, and it wasn't really letter bombs. It was just some type of incendiary device or something. But this guy was got a 5-year prison sentence, but he was allowed to make an announcement, and that was read out on the news. And he did sound, you know, like quite an articulate sort of person. And he was pointing out that in this country too, we're becoming a surveillance society, or we are a surveillance society, and it's just getting worse. So we have the 7/7 attacks, which I've done a little bit of research into as well, and it follows a very similar pattern as what's been going on here. It's just very, very similar.
Well, you know, Andrew, the 7/7 attack seemed to me so blatant because here you have this alleged anti-terrorist drill taking place, and at precisely the same stops, at precisely the same time as this drill is taking place, you have these actual explosions. It's absolutely disgraceful and transparent, and you have these railway cars where the explosion has forced the steel upward to be bent upward, which implies the explosion was placed beneath the car, not above it, as is alleged by the government.
That's right, and also we have other bits of evidence that the train that these four men were supposed to have travelled on from Luton was cancelled that morning, so they couldn't, in theory, have got there in time to set the devices off at the times that they were purported to have set them off. You know, there's all kinds of inconsistencies like that.
It's also blatant.
Yeah,
and then then having these fires that couldn't burn hot enough cause the steel to weaken, much less melt. I mean, or planes that are flying too low or too fast to be physically possible. It's all quite disgusting. And we're all being played for suckers and saps, it seems, all the time.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think one of the things we're doing, what we've been doing as a group with these accounts is, we could, if there's any lurkers out there who are just listening, and they want to come along and do some research, do some campaigning, then, come along and do it, because we need everyone, to sort of try and get involved with this in some way, shape or form. I try and say this whenever I come on the radio, buy a DVD or get a DVD off a friend and copy it and give it to people and talk about it, because that's really the only way we're going to get this information disseminated. And I think, as other people have pointed out, when we look at the plane stories and how it was really sold through the media, I mean, for example, just take the first responders. If you go through these accounts, I mean, you can do this yourself, because I've posted all the data on links to my website, and you can download the text files and look at them on your own computer if you want. And I've included in my report how, I searched for all the information. So people that have got a bit of technical nous could, do this for themselves. And, basically you can find a lot of information in there. And, thinking about, for example, the first responders initially seeing the first crash on television or hearing reports about it. And then as I went through the list, I found that quite a few of them had seen the second crash on TV as well. So by the time they get there, they've already got that idea implanted, in their head. And we've seen a number of cases, for example, where they see suitcases, and they're reported in a couple of instances. And now, on the one hand, with the official story of the planes, they say, oh, well, they were travelling so fast, and they were so big that that's what destroyed the towers, because if it had just drifted in coming into land sort of speed rather than full throttle, then that wouldn't necessarily have destroyed the towers. But yet, if we take that at face value and sort of agree, ridiculous though it is, that they were travelling at nearly 500 miles an hour, which we know they can't do that at that altitude, then how did the luggage survive? If these first responders are saying they've seen suitcases on the ground, how did they survive the fireball and the conflagration? I mean, how is that different to this ridiculous story of Mohammed Asa's passport, being found on the pavement? I mean, it's just crazy, crazy stuff.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And then you have these 100-ton airliners impacting with 500,000-ton buildings.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they leave cookie-cutter cutouts of the buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's no debris. There's no aircraft debris to be seen in relation to the buildings. I mean, if you look at real plane crashes, some into buildings, you find that that's a rather preposterous scenario. And the very idea of having cookie-cutter cutouts is not just wildly improbable, but a physical impossibility. It just wouldn't happen that way. You have variable strength of the wings and so forth. They're going to break off. They're going to be pieces, chunks, gouged, you know, into the building, and it's not going to create the kind of impression that we find having, you know, being displayed there on 9/11.
Absolutely, and I mean, you know, we've got no recorded serial numbers of parts, you know, being recovered. So, you know, we've nothing to actually prove from, as a physical chain of evidence that the planes actually did crash at the World Trade Center. And if we take the other two events, most 9/11 researchers are very suspicious about the plane stories at the Pentagon and at Shanksville. So, you know, really you're only left with the other two. And again, when you look at this evidence, all the evidence that you've just described, and the witness accounts too. I mean, just to give you one result which I came up with, I only found one witness who positively identified an American Airlines plane out of 500.
One witness who publicly identified an American Airlines plane out of 500. That doesn't sound like very persuasive evidence from witnesses who are known to be unreliable in the first place. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Andrew Johnson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Andrew Johnson, has degrees in physics and computer science from Lancaster University in the UK. He has a background in telecommunications, process control, and computer graphics, and he's been studying the witness reports from New York City in relation to the planes, and especially Flight 175, which is supposed to be an American Airlines Boeing 767 that purportedly hit the South Tower. And we all take for granted that there were so many eyewitness reports, as well as cameras that were on the towers, that, you know, it would have been preposterous to imagine that any of the film could have been faked, or that the planes might not actually have been present, that it might have been something else that hit the towers than this American Flight 175. And yet, as Andrew is reporting to us now, of the 500 witnesses whose accounts have been posted by the New York Times that he used as a database, exactly one reported seeing an American Airlines flight. And Andrew, I have to infer, therefore, that there were more reports of other kinds of aircraft than there were of an American Airlines commercial carrier.
Yeah, quite so. If I just may make a correction, I only have the one degree, which is a combined degree, a major in computer science and a sort of minor in physics. So I'm not quite as well qualified as you other sort of made out there, but that's okay.
We'll forgive you, Andrew. You've done serious work in both fields and devoted yourself principally to the field of computer science, but you have a background
right.
in physics, and, you know, most Americans, alas, are very weak in the areas of science across the board, so it's extremely valuable to somebody who for us to benefit from someone who has the competence that you bring to this case. So I take it that actually there were reports of other types of planes hitting that were more prevalent than the single report of an American Airlines plane hitting the building?
Yeah, there's quite a mixed bag, but what I can just go through, I think one of the things which Jerry Leapart was keen to establish was how many people actually heard and saw the plane. Now, the way that I kind of tried to break this down, I thought, you know, it seems fairly obvious to me that the closer that the people were to the World Trade Center, you know, you would expect more of them to actually hear the plane coming. And you would probably expect more of them to see it, at least in the last sort of few instances before it actually hit. And so I tended to focus on the accounts which, were near the World Trade Center, and I kind of did the most work with those. But I did also look for those who were driving towards the World Trade Center. I picked up, you know, many accounts where they said I was going along the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, or I was traveling down West Highway, and this sort of thing. I was coming out of the Brooklyn Tunnel. I think there were quite a few firemen staged just outside the Brooklyn Tunnel. And I picked up accounts from there.
And I take it you discovered that there were around 100 who were within a half mile of the World Trade Center at the time of the second impact, and an additional 20 or so who were inside one of the buildings at that time.
That's right. I discovered that there were 96 witnesses who were sort of, you know, attending to people and things in, around Vesey Street and, you know, and Liberty Street and all around that sort of area. And many of them, you know, did actually give a specific location down to a street, and the ones that didn't, I tended to sort of leave out of the count because, you know, I couldn't really sort of pinpoint where they actually were. And, you know, what you tended to find with some accounts is that they were quite confused, and you had a few which just didn't, you know, from reading the account, you think, well, you must have been there when the second impact occurred, but they just didn't describe it. And therefore, you sort of wonder whether they had a pretty traumatic experience, and some of, you know, some of their memory was blanked out. Because I mean, we've got to remember, you know, what these people were doing and what they witnessed. You know, and one of the other things that comes out of the accounts is the people jumping out of the windows, and to be in the midst of that actually happening, you know, is obviously extremely terrifying. Even if you're used to working in, you know, in that sort of environment, but yes, you know, it was about 100 people were near the World Trade Center. And then I had about, I think it was 21 actually inside the towers, you know, going up the stairways and trying to rescue people. So I ended up, I think, with a total of about 117. And I, just to give you some counts and actual results, I got 19 witnesses near the World Trade Center reported actually seeing Plane 2 before impact, and 20 witnesses near the World Trade Center, which is within, near, by my estimation, within half a mile, and most of them are a lot nearer than that. As I say, most of them are a couple, you know, 100 yards away, and only 20 of these witnesses actually reported hearing the plane before the impact, and only out of those, only eight of all those witnesses actually reported seeing and hearing the plane before impact. That's, you know, only 8.3% of the total.
That's really quite a fascinating figure, Andrew. I mean, basically it means out of, beginning with a database of 500, you combed through it, you sorted it out. When you determined where people were and what they were reporting, you found a total of actually only eight who reported seeing and hearing Plane 2. And even that has to be ambiguous, does it not? When you refer to it as Plane 2, there's not unanimity in the reports being offered by even these eight witnesses who report both seeing and hearing some flying object hit the building.
That's right. You know, there is some ambiguity. And, you know, you can see, for example, in the accounts, one of the other things which came out quite clearly was they sort of maybe saw the first impact on TV, or they heard it over the emergency services radio. They went to the scene. They were attending to people there. The second impact happens, and, you know, they hear it, and they report that in their account. But then a few minutes later, they'll say, I thought there was another plane coming, or a rocket, but actually what it turned out to be was the tower coming down. And you know, I've got probably seven or eight accounts, and I didn't go through all of these thoroughly. There's probably more there, where they actually say literally words to that effect. You know, I thought it was a third plane, but it was actually the tower coming down.
The North Tower.
The North Tower.
Of course, the South Tower came down first.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, there's confusion, total confusion over the sounds. You know, going back to your earlier question about reporting the type of plane, we have one account where a policeman, let me see if I can find this in the list. I'd have to sort of flick through this list here. But basically, a policeman said that he saw a rocket go from the Woolworth building into one of the towers, and he said he just cleared off. He just ran away because he told this to one of the emergency service workers.
Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating of all your reports. I mean, here's a police officer who basically is trained in the practice of observation and reporting, who frequently has to make formal reports in writing of his observations and inferences therefrom. And here he's reporting seeing a rocket fired from the Woolworth building. To me, that's among the most startling of all the reports you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, this is from the account of Peter Feluca, which is file number 9110388. And perhaps we'll just mention that after the break.
We'll come right back to it. This is my special guest, Andrew Johnson. I am your host, Jim Fetzer, on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. My special guest today, Andrew Johnson, has a background in physics and computer science and who has been analyzing the some 500 witness reports from New York City in relation to what they claim to have seen hit the South Tower, which, of course, according to the government, was a Boeing 767, and it turns out that when he analyzes some 500 reports in the database, that there are as many witnesses who report having seen the building hit by a rocket fired from the Woolworth building as there are who report having seen an American Airlines commercial airliner hit the building. Is that correct, Andrew?
Well, I suppose you could put it in those terms, yeah. I mean, the only positive idea, as I mentioned before, of an American Airlines jet was one witness that I actually found.
And we only have one witness, I take it, who's reporting the rocket fired from the Woolworth building.
Yeah, now, I'd come across this story probably a couple of years ago. There is a web page, and I remember seeing the pictures associated with it, but no other details. But this account, I'll read, is very short, comes from Peter Feluca. It's file number 9110388. All these files are numbered. Now, if people want to go, shall we do the website in case
I was going to give it at the start of the second hour, but we can give it now. It's okay. Check the Evidence.
Yeah, checktheevidence.com, all one word, and you'll get a sort of brief flash because it redirects to a kind of a
right, and when you get on to checktheevidence.com, you want to click on the New York Times icon.
Yeah, there's a New York Times icon. You can click on that. And that will take you into this article which discusses some of these findings. And at the bottom there's a link to the actual report as well, the full thing. But to go to this account, it says here, it was a big fireball or something from the plane, I guess. We'll come back to this in a minute. Came from across the street in front of our rig. And as we get out of the rig, there's a cop, city police officer in the street. He's telling us, I'm getting out of here. I just saw a rocket. He said he saw it come off the Woolworth building and hit the tower. So, you know, what did that guy see? And then I've got another account just under this, similarly brief, from Brian Dixon, 9110166. At that point, I assumed you can't have two. It can't be an incident to have two planes. So I don't know if there's planes or missiles or what. But something was hitting this thing. You saw debris falling down. So, again, you've got doubt there that a plane was involved.
Yeah, that's really quite fascinating.
So, this was one of the things that Jerry specifically asked us to look out for, in that, you've got quite a few accounts whereby, they weren't actually sure whether a plane was involved. Some specifically described a plane. But they described it in a very strange way. For example, we've got O'Flaherty. He said, just then out of the corner of my eye, I could see this plane. I just remember the dark. It was in the shadow. It looked low. I thought, what the heck is the guy doing? I watched it. I watched him turn and crash right into the South Tower. Right away, and I knew it was terrorism or terrorists. I didn't know what the first one was, but I knew what the second one was. So you're getting all kinds of odd descriptions, describing this plane as dark, or some describe it as light, various descriptions.
As you mentioned here in your report summary, quite a few witnesses were not at all sure that large planes had been responsible for the damage at the WTC. Accounts where they said, quote, I didn't realize it was a plane at the time, or quote, I only realized later it was a plane, were studied. Due to the different ways witnesses described being unsure about the true nature of the crash, it was difficult to pick out keywords to find these accounts. Time limitations may have prevented finding them all. But a number of witnesses reported they didn't realize that the second impact was that of a plane. Many of them found out later. which is, of course, a direct contradiction to those who reported seeing plane parts, engine parts, and landing gear. At least those, of course, aren't the same thing as actually seeing the plane hit the building. For example, no. I have a report, Andrew, that you may be able to corroborate that a landing gear that was found on the street was not only discovered under a canopy, turned out to be a landing gear from a Boeing 737, but that the sidewalk on which it had purportedly landed, you know, from great distance, mm-hmm. presumably with great force, was basically mm-hmm. completely undamaged.
Absolutely, and this is another area of discrepancy in the accounts. I did a search for tire, you know, aircraft tire, and I found, just to give you a couple of bits of the accounts here, we got in front of 90 West Street. We held up there for a few minutes underneath the scaffolding to reassess the situation, how we were going to get into the building. There was all kinds of human debris. The landing gear of an aircraft was in that parking lot there. So I had a report of one in the parking lot on West Street. And then another account says, we did see part of, I didn't see it, but Jeff Johnson told me later on, he did see part of the landing gear actually fell right through the roof, and it was in one of the jacuzzis in another room. So again, he's, you know, through the account of somebody else, he's saying it was a specific location in a jacuzzi somewhere. And then there was an account of one also on West Street where he said there were body parts all over. I saw an airplane tire, walked past an airplane tire, and he specifically says a tire. So again, how did this survive? How did it survive the fireball? And we can see this picture, which is Morgan Reynolds has got in his article, several of his articles, under the scaffolding. How? And you can see the rubber is just it's punctured and sort of in scuffed condition, but it's not burnt. So how did this thing survive?
Yes. Yeah, I think what we're putting together, and I'll repeat this at the when we resume after our next break. But you have this question about video, the authenticity of the videos, and the possibility that something might have hit the buildings other than planes, or who knows, maybe there were no planes at all, no flying objects at all. If the videos are authentic, then, of course, there must have been planes, since the videos display planes coming toward it, except it turns out that there are multiple different videos that are inconsistent with one another. Some show a plane coming in a steady horizontal trajectory. Others show a plane changing in altitude quite substantially. Others show, taken from the same perspective at the same time, or what appears to be the same perspective at the same time, shows no plane at all. Those are for openers. Then we have a whole lot of anomalies in the video footage. It turns out that what was being broadcast on a 17-second delay in relation to when the events were supposed to have been taking place. So there's the possibility of video fakery. Now, what's most interesting is you could have video fakery and real planes if, for example, the video fakery was intended to conceal features of the plane or of their interaction with the building or of the features of the flying objects. I mean, you know, one possibility, Andrew, I'm sure this has crossed your mind, would have been that the video fakery was to conceal that, say, a missile was a cruise missile. Was flying toward the building, and that they were concealing that it was a missile by superimposing the image of a plane. That's a possibility. I take it there are reasons for discounting it, but it's another possibility for consideration. So that even if there is a video fakery, that in and of itself doesn't settle whether there were or were not planes.
Well, I think, you know, some flying object was involved. What it was, I don't know. I don't go for the idea that it was necessarily plane size. I'll speak a little bit more about my own thoughts on that when we come back.
Perfect. We'll be right back. What we're doing is looking at the eyewitness testimony to see whether it tends to substantiate the official account or not. And Andrew Johnson, my special guest, has discovered lots of problems in the data. Stand by. Jim Fetzer, your host, the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today, my special guest, Andrew Johnson, is a 9/11 activist and researcher from the United Kingdom. He has a background in physics and computer science, and he's been studying a database provided by the New York Times of some 500 witnesses who were in the vicinity of New York and the Twin Towers, and many of whom made reports about planes and so forth. And he's been culling that database to see the results. Now, just to set up the scenario that we're discussing here, and you can find his summary report, by the way, on checktheevidence.com. So go to checktheevidence.com, and you'll see the basic document we're talking about. We have a background of issues related to video fakery in the presence or absence of planes at the World Trade Center. Part of what raises these issues is a series of studies, most recently by September Clues, in the series called September Clues, now in 8 parts, where one could contest various of those parts and still have significant residual evidence that something could be going on. It turns out that what was being broadcast on a 17-second delay, which would have been provided an opportunity to feed prepared images into what was being broadcast if it were so desired. That's discussed in part 5. Part 2 discusses multiple different inconsistent images of planes or something approaching the building. Some include a plane coming at a steady horizontal clip. Others of varying altitude, significantly, clearly incompatible. Others show no plane at all, where it's impossible that all of these should be authentic at the same time. In fact, Ace Baker has now studied the frames for the horizontal approach and found every other frame has the background identical with the frame before, even though the plane is moving forward, so that the dissipation of the smoke from the building is exactly the same as it was a moment before, which obviously would be impossible if they were authentic. In addition, we have not just the inconsistencies, but the improbabilities in relation to, say, the cookie cutter cutout, and this is between an improbability and impossibility, and the fact that there's nothing crumpled, broken off, no wreckage below the impact zone, nothing in the gashes, that these, as Morgan Reynolds has described it, are the cleanest crash sites in aviation history. That seems incredibly unlikely. And then we get the issues of the impossibilities. I mean, when Judy Wood showed a colleague of hers in mechanical engineering the cookie cutter cutouts, he knew immediately that something was wrong, because no actual plane impacting a building would leave a cookie cutter cutout, and like the Roadrunner in a cartoon, leading some to surmise that what we're viewing or cartoon images of what actually took place. The speed at which all this is supposed to have occurred is another important issue, where MIT estimated that the flight 175 heading the tower, heading toward the South Tower, was flying at 503, the British Royal Air Force 575, the FAA 586, NIST 546, FEMA 590. I added and divided and got an average of 560 miles an hour. Turns out that the highest speed, the velocity that cannot be exceeded by a 767 is 593 miles an hour. It may be knots at 35,000 feet, so that its cruising speed is actually 563, so that according to these reports, we have a cruising speed of approximately 560 miles an hour in terms of the plane hitting the building. Now, Joseph Keith, who is an aeronautical engineer who actually designed the shaker system for Boeing, has said that this is preposterous. This cannot happen, that the maximum speed at between 700 and 1,000 feet would be 330 miles an hour, and that the plane would start to shake apart at 220 miles an hour. And without suggesting that any of these claims are indisputable, that does seem to pose a rather serious question as to whether or not we're viewing faked imagery here. In addition, Ace Baker has observed that there's the wing vortex phenomenon, where like little tornadoes that are horizontal are being generated by planes' wings in flight, and that they can affect cloud patterns in space, for example, and any other, you know, substance of dust or whatever would be distorted by them. And so when we have, for example, the plane hitting the North Tower, that there's this enormous fireball and dust, and yet none of it is affected by the vortex. And that suggests, of course, that it's fake, too, because that seems to be an impossibility. So we have multiple evidence here that the videos may be faked. Now, the question becomes, could they have been faked in order to conceal features of the planes or of their interaction with the building that needed to be concealed? And here, it's extremely interesting to look at the eyewitness reports, which have been the basis for so much presumption that, of course, you know, planes actually did hit the building. And here, Andrew Johnson has picked up the task of surveying some 500 reports in a New York Times database of first responders who are claiming to have seen something there, and he's been culling those reports to see what we actually find. And after he goes through this database of 500 reports, he finds only 19 witnesses near the World Trade Center reported actually seeing what we will refer to as Plane 2 before the impact. Only 20 of the witnesses near the World Trade Center reported actually hearing what we'll call Plane 2. And only 8 of the witnesses near the World Trade Center reported actually seeing and hearing what we're calling Plane 2. So actually we have only 8 out of 500 witnesses in the total database who are making that report. That's a pretty small percentage. Not only that, but fascinating enough, when he studies the actual content of the descriptions, he finds there is only one who actually identifies what's hitting the building as an American Airlines aircraft, just as there turns out to be one who reports having seen a rocket hit the building that was fired from the Woolworth building. So it turns out that there are as many who reported seeing a rocket hit the building, a rocket that was fired from the Woolworth building, as there are who report having seen an American Airlines plane hit the building. Andrew, is that a fair synopsis just to orient those who may be joining us for this second hour?
Yeah, that's a pretty fair synopsis of what I've found out. I think, you know, one of the impressions that I got from reading the accounts, which I haven't really written into the report, but I can sort of say it just as a general feeling more than a direct conclusion, but I get the feeling that whatever... you know, whatever caused the second impact was different to whatever caused the first impact. If we look at it from the point of view of trying to actually convince people planes were involved, then I can see an argument where they might want to try and make a better job of the first one, because they knew that by the time the second one happened, they could put it on TV. And they could sell the story through TV, which I think the September Clues series demonstrates fairly strongly that that's what right. They seem to have done. They actually used the media to sell the story, and I think there are some other indications in the account that's you know, that was a big part of the plan. You know, and there was a couple of things I wanted to go back to in terms of the actual doubt about planes. One of the accounts, for example, is Patricia Ondrovich, and I know that Judy Wood has included part of her testimony in one of the RFCs for different reasons, but if we just read a bit of her account where she said, I saw a police captain that I knew and he came out to me. He looked absolutely terrified. He was shaking, he was pale, he was sweating. I looked at him, I said, what's wrong? He said, there's another plane headed our way, and just blew up against him. I said, another plane? What are you talking about? I hadn't realised planes had hit this. I thought they just set bombs off. I didn't realise when I got there that planes had hit it. I said, what do you mean another plane? And she talks about Cessna planes. And she said, I had no idea that planes were involved.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Andrew Johnson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Andrew Johnson, has been culling through some 500 reports from early responders, witnesses who were in the vicinity of the World Trade Center to figure out what they did or did not say they saw. It's a fascinating report. We have a rather substantial amount of evidence now that suggests that there was video fakery here that includes, for example, that the plane allegedly involved here, according to an expert, Joseph Keith, couldn't possibly have flown at the 560 miles an hour it's alleged to have flown. It would have shaken apart. Just to understand why that would have taken place, the air density at 1,000 feet is 134 times. The air density at 35,000 feet, where its cruising speed is 563. And what this means is at the lower level, the turbine simply can't suck that thick air through the engine fast enough. So it starts functioning as a brake and would cause the plane to shatter apart. Now, I understand that there's a group or some individuals and pilots for 9/11 Truth who are trying to, who are preparing a rebuttal to this claim. But frankly, I think it's going to be very difficult to dispute in addition, there have been all of these studies called September Clues and Genghis that are archived on Scholars for 9/11 Truth, because this is such a fascinating and important issue. You'll find the 8 parts of September Clues, 4 parts of Genghis 6199's epic, a lot of good stuff there. And above it, you'll find right on the homepage, new evidence, Flight 175, impossible speed addressing this issue. And this, of course, makes it all the more important then we go back and look at the rest of the evidence that's supposed to substantiate the government's official claim that 2 Boeing 767s hit the North and the South Twin Towers, respectively. Here, Andrew Johnson's work seems to me to be superb. It's the kind of demanding, painstaking, you know, hands-on effort that is required to sort all these issues out. And, Andrew, I just want to compliment you in undertaking this research. Anyone who wants to read Andrew's summary report can find it at the website he has for checktheevidence.com, checktheevidence.com. Andrew, why don't you continue with your summary of what you have discovered, because it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, thank you, Jim. Yeah, just as a point, I think, you know, there's been quite a lot of argument about aspects of September Clues, as you kind of alluded to, and I think my sort of key question in that is, did the media broadcast any fake footage knowingly on 9/11? You know, not so much how much of it was fake, or was all of it fake, or how was it fake, but did they knowingly broadcast any fake footage? And I think the answer to that question has to be yes. And that's, one of the serious sort of questions that we're going to have to deal with over time.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, because here we're talking about, as we discovered in the case of the premature report by the BBC, which at 4:57 was reporting that the collapse of Building 7, and you can see Building 7 over the left shoulder of the reporter as she's conveying this information to the public, what a stunning example of complicity between the intelligence agencies, the mass media, in this case the BBC and the American government. And I think what you're talking about is another illustration here. It looks as though that was taking place in New York City, too, in relation to these broadcasts earlier in the day involving the impact of the planes with the buildings. And a point you've made, Andrew, deserves emphasis, namely a lot of these people who thought they saw the planes hit the building actually were basing their recollection on having observed television footage that was broadcast. That is the very issue at dispute. And, of course, the way the human mind functions, we tend to seek closure. We look for explanations that tie things together. And if there's an explosion in those buildings, we're interested in what could have brought it about. And if we're seeing broadcast footage that shows planes hitting the building, we think, aha, that explains it. And we tend to assume that that's accurate.
Absolutely, and I think the key aspect in this is putting people into a state of fear. And once you're in a state of fear, it prevents you from using your intellectual processes more effectively. And that's the way this whole thing has worked on so many levels.
Now, of the 500 witnesses you had in your original database, it turns out you find only 8 of whom actually report both seeing and hearing what we're referring to as plane 2, and yet there's great inconsistency in what it is that's supposed to be this plane 2, where actually you've discovered only one who identified it as an American Airlines plane. And as I've been emphasizing, we contrast that with the one report we have of it having been a rocket instead that was fired into the building from the Woolworth store, so that there was many, you know, that reported the latter as the former.
Yes, that's right. And I think, again, you know, the whole idea of confusion over the planes really stands out in quite a number of accounts. And just if I can read a portion of another one here, and this is from the account of firefighter David Sandvik. This is an extraordinary one, because he says, we start heading down the block and we get down to, I guess, about Church Street, which, of course, is right next to the World Trade Center, and the second plane hit. And I remember just being underneath. So he says it's actually underneath. I never heard the motor of the plane, the sound of the engines. We just heard the explosion. You felt the explosion. And looking straight up and seeing that fireball you see on the news, but we're underneath it, looking up now at it. So he says he's right underneath when this thing hits, and he doesn't hear it. So this is an extraordinary account.
Yeah, I think that's quite striking. That's quite striking. The plane obviously is going to make a tremendous amount of noise. These things, these jet engines are enormously loud and could be heard for great distances. That's another point Morgan has emphasized in various of his research. By the way, these brilliant studies by Morgan Reynolds and by Ace Baker are included, were presented at the Madison Conference, and we're preparing the DVDs now. But I think anyone who has a serious interest in these issues is not going to want to miss what they did in Madison during this conference. Their presentation were simply superb. Let's continue, Andrew, by your going through, just read us a whole lot of these and give us your comments on what you discovered in terms of these witness reports.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot more to come out. And again, going back to the theme of the confusion over the planes, there's this one, which is Scott Hollowatch, and he says, at that time, Chief Ganci, G-A-N-C-I, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, was behind me, and he thought there was another explosion in the North Tower. And that's when I turned around and said, Chief, listen, this is a second plane that hit the other tower. He was like, no, we have another explosion. I said, no, Chief, I witnessed it. I watched the plane hit the tower. He was like, are you sure? I said, Chief, I'm 100% positive. I watched the second plane hit the tower. So these two people have stood next to each other, and they can't agree that a plane hit the tower. So again, that's a pretty extraordinary account.
Yeah, I'm very puzzled by Scott Hollowatch Watch's report, you know, how he's explained to the chief, how he witnessed it, he watched it. Do we have anything more from him about what it was he thinks he saw or claims to have seen?
I haven't got anything in the report. There may be, you know, that account may be worth further study to see what he says after that.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Andrew Johnson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Andrew Johnson from the UK, has a background in physics and computer science, and he's been doing a data mining search on a database that includes some 500 reports provided by the New York Times of witnesses to the events in New York City. And rather astonishingly, what he has discovered after combing through this database is he has found only one witness who reports seeing an American Airlines plane hit the building. Sometimes, Andrew, I think reporting these things in the opposite way can have even more impact. Out of a 500 witness database you've called, 499 out of 500 do not report having observed an American Airlines plane hit the South Tower.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what comes out of it, because, you know, quite a number of those, I think it was over 200, saw the attacks on television. So, you know, that rules out a lot of direct eyewitness testimony at a stroke, really.
So let's please do proceed by reading through some of the witness reports that you found especially interesting and comment on them as you think appropriate.
Sure. And I think, you know, getting to this idea of them actually trying to implant the plane stories and working at that idea. Again, I found other evidence for this, and this was in the form, if I can read a bit of this account here and then lead on to another one. This is a short extract from Chris Kaganar, and he says, what happened was then the second plane hit the tower, and it was a loud noise. I mean, it hit, and at first I was like, this can't be happening. It's like lightning doesn't strike twice. As I'm dropping off the patient, the FBI agent comes up to me and he says, oh man, I just heard there's a third plane coming in. So we get this idea that the FBI are actually on the ground, or somebody looking like the FBI anyway, saying, you know, more planes are on the way. And I discovered this reference to a third plane coming to New York in three or four different accounts. But the most extraordinary one of this type was from Terence Rivera, and he said, I'll read this because it's a really strange account. He said, he wasn't a regular security guard. He had a weapon on him. I don't know if he was FBI or Secret Service. And he was trying to put the pants out on one individual that was conscious. His pants were still smouldering. I took the can, fire extinguisher off the truck, and then sprayed down the pants on the person that was still conscious. At that time, I had asked him, where did this individual come from? He told me, when the plane had hit, a fireball had shot down the elevator shaft and had blown people out of the lobby. So this is a story, again, that we've heard several times before, and then he continues. Sometime, while we were doing that, that same individual that was, when we first got there, that was trying to put the pants out, he came over and he is saying to us that it's a terrorist attack. You guys are too close. It's a terrorist attack. Then I went, that same individual, the security, or he told me to go over to the command post and let them know it's a terrorist attack. There are more planes in the air. So he's giving quite a detailed account there of this encounter with this supposed FBI agent.
That's extremely interesting, trying to plant that idea, like the so-called civilian caught on network television saying who could explain exactly what happened, that the planes hit the building and their fuel caused the fires that overwhelmed the structural integrity and caused the buildings to collapse. There, in a matter of seconds, he's giving out the whole government's, a thumbnail sketch of the government's whole official account. One of my favorites, Anthony, among those you've accumulated, is Anthony Bartholomew, who says, did any civilians report anything to you? And he says, yes, numerous civilians were telling me that a plane had hit the building. There were discrepancies as to the type of plane. Some were saying it was a Cessna or a Learjet type, a small jet plane. Some said it was a large passenger plane. One person actually said it was like a military-style plane that actually shot missiles into the building.
Yeah.
So again, I reiterate, there's many who reported that it was a military plane that fired missiles into the building, as there were those who reported it was an American Airlines commercial airliner that hit the building.
That's right. You've got a variety of stories, and quite a common theme which comes out when you're reading is that initially people thought it was a small plane, but I think was partly because they didn't witness anything, or they were just getting the first stories off the TV. But yeah, certainly even witnesses that were there on the ground said, we thought it was a Cessna or a small plane. So there's a lot of confusion, and as you mentioned, there are several accounts mentioning missiles. I think I found about three or four specifically mentioning missiles.
What one of the features that most interesting in Rick Siegel's 9/11 eyewitness, of course, is the presence of helicopters circling the building. Did you get any reports of helicopters out of this particular database?
Well, what I did get was, and I'm trying to find the account, but there was one witness who was down, I think, near the pier. She was quite a distance away, probably about maybe sort of a mile away, maybe a mile and a half, on one of the piers somewhere near there. And her report made me smile initially, but I think I understood it, what she actually saw, because she said she saw the plane circling the building several times and then crashing into it. And initially I thought, well, this is just ridiculous that somebody should see the plane circling the building and then crashing into it. But then I thought, well, perhaps whatever hit on the second impact was actually only about the size of a helicopter. And if that was the case, then it would be easy for her to kind of, from a certain angle, see what the helicopter's going around and then see this object, whatever it was, coming in, and maybe confusing that with a helicopter.
So once again, we have as many witnesses as report having seen the plane circle the building multiple times before it impacted with it, as reported that there was an American Airlines commercial airliner that hit it.
Yeah, I mean, there were actually two witnesses who reported the plane circling the building.
Actually, twice as many.
Yeah,
twice as many witnesses as reported seeing an American Airlines plane hit the building, reported seeing the plane circle the building repeated times before it actually impacted with it. That's fascinating, Andrew.
Yeah. I mean, again, if people want to do this, they can download all the text files that I generated from the PDF files, download the free text search software. It's just a bit of freeware that, it didn't cost anything. And you can run these sorts of searches for yourself and check out, this is why it's quite a good study, because it's sort of like a bit of desktop research. You've got all the information available. You can check it all yourself. You don't really have to kind of cross-reference it with anything else in particular. It's a self-contained unit of information. So you can work from it quite confidently.
A point that bears repetition, so you can count on me to repeat it, is that anyone who has thought that the questions of video fakery and planes or no planes to the World Trade Center was just nonsense, I think, is simply unfamiliar with the evidence.
Mm.
When you study the mass of accumulation of September clues, of Genghis, of the impossible speed, Baker's work, for example, Chopper 5 composite, the work of Morgan Reynolds, and what you're doing here, it seems to me there's overwhelming evidence that something is terribly wrong, that this story just doesn't hang together. It's incoherent. And you have to step back and ask yourself, what's wrong with this picture?
That's right. And this is really, what you do in science. You gather all the data, you study it, and you try and draw conclusions. And of course, quite often you have to change those conclusions in the light of new evidence. And I think bad science and bad analysis is when you sort of fix a conclusion and then you refuse to look at the evidence which may change your conclusion. And that's when the problems arise in so many areas of study and why things don't progress
That's absolutely right. A failure to adhere to the standards of scientific reasoning, which not only require basing your reasons on all the available relevant evidence, but reassessing the inferential situation when you encounter new hypotheses and new evidence. We'll be right back with my special guest, Andrew Johnson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today has been Andrew Johnson, who has a background in computer science and physics and who's been surveying a database of 500 witnesses provided by the New York Times to determine what they had to say about planes impacting the towers, especially the South Tower. And Andrew, I can't begin to tell you how important your work is. In fact, it assumes increasing significance when you realize that, say, not only are some members of pilots apparently going to try to prove that what Joseph Keith has said is impossible, namely a Boeing 767 flying at its cruising speed at 35,000 feet at only 1,000 feet or below, they're going to try to prove that that actually is possible. But we have Anthony Lawson, who's a very distinguished fellow, who's won lots of awards for his video productions, who has produced This Is an Orange and 9/11, The Towers of Dust, which I consider to be simply superb, who is disputing the kinds of arguments being presented by September Clues. And I know that I'm going to have a link to his latest effort, Anthony being very convinced that all of the video footage is indeed authentic, so that there's going to be, arguments made on both sides. I happen to believe that the preponderance of the evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of video fakery, and this simply places additional emphasis on what the eyewitnesses had to say, even though I don't consider the eyewitness testimony to be the most reliable. Surely, the violations of laws of physics and of aerodynamics take first place, and improbabilities take second place, and then what witnesses have to say somehow are third in the order of evidential weight. But yet, what you're turning up is showing that it's really chaotic out there.
Absolutely, and I agree with what you say, and I think one of the situations we often seem to find is that you take something like September Clues, and you take it as a whole unit. Is everything in it 100% accurate and correct? Well, probably not. So Anthony Lawson, I've corresponded with him too, and he's picked up a couple of sort of items from the series and focused in on them and said, well, I think this part is probably bogus. Therefore, the guy who made it is not being honest. And I sort of pointed out to him, well, there's two possibilities. He may be being dishonest, or he may just have made a mistake. And I think, it's very difficult to tell the difference. And so I don't think he can suddenly conclude that the whole series is totally wrong just on one particular shot. I think that's a very dangerous way of looking at things.
Well, you're completely right. I mean, it's a logical blunder. If we have already discovered, say, 24 arguments, and if any of those 24 is sufficient to show that there was video fakery or no planes, showing that the others, even if it was 23 of the 24, are mistaken isn't enough to disprove the one that actually demonstrates video fakery or no planes. So there's just a colossal blunder going on here. The difference between verification and falsification, all you need is one bona fide example to falsify a hypothesis like this, and there, no number that show that it's accurate actually can ever conclusively verify it, because there may yet be respects that you haven't considered yet that would demonstrate that, in fact, actually what's going on is full of chicanery.
Yeah. I mean, if we could just go back to these accounts before the end of the program, because
please,
there's a couple of things which I wanted to bring out in terms of kind of just joining up with Judy Wood's research, and which, I'm an absolute, enormous fan of what Judy's done. It's totally mind-blowing how she's done it, and, absolutely all credit to her, and Morgan Reynolds as well. And the pictorial record that Judy's put together, it's just, as you've said yourself, it's astonishing, really. And I think, some of this was reflected in the witness accounts, and I feel this is another area where we, as a group, we could probably do quite a bit more research into these accounts and pull out some more data on this. And one of the things, for example, I've got the account of Robert Ruiz, and he said, like things weren't bad enough already, the car that's parked right on the corner catches on fire. I don't mean a little fire, the entire thing. Don't ask me how. The entire car caught on fire. you would think maybe just a motor part or just the engine part, but this entire car goes up in fire. And so this is a sort of spontaneous car fire that he's describing. And then we've got another short one from fire patrolman Paul Curran. He said at that time I went back to the North Tower again and they were stretching a line. A lot of car fires erupted. All of a sudden cars were blowing up everywhere. It was bad from the beginning and it went totally haywire when the other tower collapsed. It was just nothing but damage and debris. It was just bodies, body parts. And so he's describing these car fires actually getting worse as the tower is collapsing. So that, to me, you know, was really an interesting bit of an account that he was giving there.
Were any of those, were those cars actually being driven on the street as opposed to being parked cars? Was that distinction ever drawn by any of the witnesses?
I think in one or two cases it was, but I'd have to probably study it more. I would imagine that most of those cars that he's referring to would have been parked at that point. I didn't sort of get any accounts of cars actually moving, because, I mean, by that time I think that these things happened, most of the area would have been closed off for the emergency services.
Of course, if the cars are parked, that could explain why you don't have, you know, any residue of humanity there, even if you might not have had any humanity there if they were being driven. But, I mean, those are two different cases from an evidential point of view.
Yeah, and, you know, there are other accounts of sort of, there's one account in here, I'm not sure I've got time to find it, but basically where he goes back to the ambulance to try and recover equipment, and it's just been totally destroyed, you know, there's nothing left of it, and they couldn't recover anything. So there's quite a few accounts of that as well.
Why don't you read a couple more of the more interesting accounts?
Sure. now, we've got... One of the other things which really came out a lot as well was the mistaking of the sound of the tower collapsing for another plane or rocket approaching. Faisal Abed, he said, "You just heard this thrushing noise like a rocket. I thought the building was under attack again. You just start seeing this smoke coming down. We just took off. We went north. We went west. We went towards the river, all right. Then we just went towards the river and went up a little north." That was after the first one went down. So he describes this tower coming down as a thrushing noise. And then another witness said, Robert LaRocco said, "Kind of like those rockets that they launched the space shuttles with. It was like I had one off going off in each ear. I thought it was the loudest noise I ever heard. Every second it was just increasing, getting louder and louder, and I was running as fast as I could." And this is when the South Tower was coming down that he describes this. And what struck me is, well, you know, for a long time I thought, well, the towers were taken down with controlled demolition. But if we think of controlled demolition in the conventional sense, you know, we've seen all the demonstrations, we've all watched the comparative videos, you know, indeed I made them in the past, where we hear this bang, 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 and then the building drops. And none of the witness accounts that I came across described that sort of bang, bang, bang sequence and then the tower coming down. Most of them described it like the sound of another plane or a rocket or a missile or just a rumbling, roaring sound. And there was none of this bang, 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 bang. So I don't think from the witness accounts of the sounds we have any evidence that it was a detonation sequence which brought the towers down.
Yes, yes, yes. Although I think the term controlled demolition has to be construed very broadly. Any demolition that's under some kind of control. I mean, it could be from the top down, from the bottom up, from the middle up and down. It could be a whole lot of things. But just so long as it's under control, being intentional, it seems to me it qualifies in the broad sense, and that a lot of traction has been achieved by trying to define controlled demolition so narrowly that if it isn't a classic bottom-up using explosives, it isn't a controlled demolition.
Oh, yes, I would agree with your sort of broad brush sort of view on that. But, you know, again, we've had before the discussion of the squibs in the towers, and they were the detonation charges going off as the tower was coming down. Now, I want to make it clear that, you know, there seemed to be more accounts of explosions going off before the towers came down, but not during the collapses.
Anthony Johnson, Andrew Johnson, I can't thank you enough for your excellent work. I'm really proud to have you as a member of Scholars, and I'm very grateful for all you're doing. Keep up the good work. Those who want to visit Andrew's website should go to checktheevidence.com, checktheevidence.com. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.